Okay, good morning. So we're holding in Perek Yotes. We were a little bit in the midst of Perek Yotes of the Gvurais Hashem. Vayeshev ala be'er. What we're going to move into here today is the discussion of the zivug, of the marriage of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is the next step in the story. As Moshe Rabbeinu leaves Mitzrayim, he goes to Midian, and he ends up, of course, staying in Midian, marrying the daughter of Yisro Kohen Midian. So it says, Vayeshev ala be'er. He went there and he settled, not lived, but he sat and he stayed by the be'er, by the well. And, you know, this is just another example, a biblical example of somebody going to the local watering hole to find a mate. Right? So this is the Vayeshev ala be'er. We had it by Yitzchak's Zivug. Right? Eliezer went to the well. Yaakov went to the well and found Rachel. And Moshe Rabbeinu goes to the well. And this is something which is discussed significantly. Morale here dedicates just a short paragraph to the idea, and he says something very important, and at the same time something which could be easily, of course, misunderstood or understood and taken the wrong way, and so on. So let's see what he says. He says, Ha'isha nikreis be'er. He brings a pasuk in Mishlei, Shasei Maimi Be'erach, which is understood as alluding to the woman, that the woman herself is called Be'er. It's called the well. And that's why, again, part of why he posits, why it keeps becoming the case that they are finding their wives by the Be'er, by the well. And another example or another illustration of the relationship between the woman and the Be'er is that we know there's a Talmudic tradition that the Jewish people merited three special gifts that took care of them when we were in the Midbar: the clouds of Hashem's presence because of Aaron, the Mun because of Moshe, and the Be'er because of Miriam. So there again, we find that the woman is specifically associated with the Be'er, with the well. So what's the idea behind this? And the Maral writes, Vizekia Be'er hu shenaivea milmata lamala. Chol shardvorim boe milmala lamata. He says, when you speak about water sources, what we're used to speaking about is rain that descends from above to below. So when you speak, for example, about a boer, which is a reservoir, which collects rainwater, it collects rainwater down here, but it's rain which came from above. Whereas a be'er is a well. And a well, as we see it, is drawing upon waters from the depths that bubble up, that come up, and that's how we are going to be able to access them. And so he says that is a core image of the relationship of Isha Labala, of the woman to her husband. Because what is described, first of all, in the pasuk in Parshas Bereishis is Vel Ishech Teshukasech, that the woman yearns to go towards her husband. She yearns for her husband. In the Gemara, there is a responsibility and a mitzvah for a man to marry a woman, and it's his responsibility to go and to Kiyikach Ishisha. He has to be the one to take the woman as a wife. But as well, going along with that is an inherent desire of the woman to be married. The Gemara says, Tav lemeisav tandu mi lemeisav armalu. The woman has a real definite desire to be married. Almost whatever. You know, that's the way the Gemara says it. And it's a difficult thing. You have to know what it means. You can't throw that around, bandy that statement around. But it remains a standing umdana. It remains a standing assumption. And when you study social science and things like that about women, so they speak about this idea that men are fundamentally independent, competitive creatures, and women are fundamentally creatures of connection, who would rather be, you know, have some kind of a chibur, have some kind of a connection to others. That defines in a general sense the nature of personality. There was a famous sort of big public argument when a significant modern Orthodox rabbi tried to make certain changes in order to create a resolution to the Aguna problem, which is a major problem. And he tried to do it, and used in doing so, he was trying to also make a change, suggest that in today's day and age, the assumption of the Gemara of Tav, Milameisav Tandu, Milameisav Armalu, that the woman's essential desire to be with somebody else is no longer the reality due to the changes in the times. And Rav Yosha Ber Soloveitchik was very absolute. He came out very strongly and publicly against this position, that these assumptions which the Gemara says about human nature are not things which change. Certain expression of things change. Rabbi Yosha Ber, you know, was teaching Gemara to women. They did something which he felt was different today than it was before. But that was, he felt that the basic assumptions are to some degree still in place. So one way or the other, he says that there's a yearning of the woman for the husband. And he says, Vizehu hishtaikikus shel ilui. And he writes, and again, this is something which is, again, prone easily to misunderstanding, misappropriation. He says this is a yearning to come up. Kio ish yeser b'mala b'erecha isha v'him ishtaikekes lisales b'bala. Because there's a certain ilui, there's a certain raised level which the male is supposed to have, and the woman is yearning towards that. And therefore it's like the be'er, the well, which comes from below and yearns to rise up, to well up, to bubble up. What's the idea that the Maral is expressing here in this idea? So in these lines, so the way the Maral writes it in many places is the idea of Chaimer Vitzura, where he associates the woman with matter and the male with form. And in a certain sense, we can explain it this way, that in a classic situation where the woman is building the home and the internally, and the husband is out and pursuing whatever it is that he is pursuing, career-wise, within the world as a whole. So what happens is that the home is the platform and the support system and the base for the activities, the broader activities of the family. And the broader activities of the family are to some degree seen as the activities of tzura. They're the activities of form, of direction. Choose a simple example, which is found in the Gemara in a couple of places, where it speaks about Talmud Torah. Right? When in the morning we make a bracha, Shalei Asani Isha, blessed are you Hashem who did not make me a woman, we're saying it, according to virtually everybody, because of the extra mitzvah opportunities, most notably Talmud Torah, which is the charge of the man. When the woman says Shasani Kirtzono, she's saying, look, I don't have those opportunities, I accept absolutely my role nevertheless. So the Gemara says that the woman is nevertheless having a share of the rewards of Talmud Torah. Why? Because she sends her children to go and study Torah. She waits for her husband when he goes out to the Beis Medrash and then comes back, and she's supportive of the Talmud Torah of the man. So therefore, if it's not something that she's doing herself, and yet we consider it to be the ultimate endeavor, the Gemara speaks of Talmud Torah as being that which brings the ultimate rewards, the ultimate Olam Haba for a person, so then what is her association going to be with it? Her association is going to be with it in her supportive role that she's going to be able to play. And in a certain sense, whatever he does is going to therefore bring her along. That's what we speak about of the Hishtaikikus Ha'isha Labala. When we speak about Naida Bashorim Bala Beshifta Yim Zikne Oretz. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. When we speak in the Eshes Chaya, we speak about how her husband's prominence in the gates, when he sits with the elders of the land, right? So to some degree, again, the open, visible, broader impact is going to be made by those who are functioning outside. And the woman's hishtaikikus labala, to some degree, is she's not going to be playing the same external prominent role, but through her association with him, she's going to be able to have it. And that's a yearning to be ola, to rise in significance, to rise in impact and prominence in that way. And yes, so that's, you know, that's the way this is understood. And you know, here we could look at it and we can say, okay, so as a result of this, we can look down. We can look down on women, because it describes here that they're looking up and trying to rise up, you know, to somehow connect to the husband who is higher. On the other hand, we can also look at it as a responsibility, because I know that, you know, many times we look at ourselves and we say, one second, who's higher exactly? You know, we look and we know that the great role and impact that is had by the Isha, and it's our responsibility, if we are taking that external role to be helped and supported and encouraged, you know, in all of these things, so then we better be worthy of it. We better be something that's worthy of that result. So that's, in short, this very important topic of Isha Labala, of Vateshevah Be'er. Vateshevah Be'er. Yeah.
So when Moshe comes to he's entering into that relationship? Is that the concept?
I mean,
what's the idea of him coming to a place that is a
bear? Well, Moshe Rabbeinu, of the three instances which we have, we don't know anything in the pasuk that Moshe Rabbeinu came here for the purposes of marriage. When Eliezer went to the Be'er, he went for marriage, for Yitzchak. When Yaakov went to the Be'er, while he was going to run away, on the one hand, from Esav, he was also going to get married. Right? Go to my brother Lavan, and he'll take a wife for you from there. That's what Yitzchak had instructed Yaakov to Rivka's brother Lavan. That's what Yitzchak had instructed Yaakov to do. So they were going specifically for it. So they chose a spot which was suitable. Moshe Rabbeinu, we don't have anything that's explicit that says in the pasuk in any which way that Moshe Rabbeinu went there for the sake of a zivug. However, he went there, and that's indeed what ended up happening. So the Maharal is just explaining why, in a certain sense, hamokaim gairim, there are places which are just more suitable for such a thing to happen. And because the Be'er represents this upward mobility of something from below coming and trying to lift itself up, so that is, in a sense, the drive in the zivug, the drive in marriage, the way he has described it, of the hishtaikikus, of the yearning of the isha labal, of the woman for her husband.
I'm just thinking of how the bear works exactly. I mean, you dig down to the water level and then you lift it. I mean, how exactly the water has to come up? Is there an idea of? I mean, I'm thinking of in terms compared to a spring that just comes up by itself. I guess would not be, because
a spring, you know, when you think of a spring, you think of Old Faithful. You know, you think of something which is spritzing. But wells generally is where you somehow find the water table. You find, I'm not no expert in this, but there's water that's beneath the surface of the earth. And you are accessing it, and it replenishes itself. It rises. Especially, you know, it always describes, but by Rivka and by Rachel, that the Mayim, the water, rose to greet them. Yeah.
Actually, exactly the same thing, but it is interesting that you find that in the three cases that all the women were actually playing the roles of men by being at the well. So really, it was a man's job to be there. They were all there because there wasn't anybody else, or whatever it is. I'm not sure that kind of fits in, but it is kind of interesting that they were playing that role by being there.
It may be. You look at it a little bit more. It's interesting that when it came to Yitzchak, she mamish played the role, because she took care of all the camels. She took care of Eliezer. But when it came to Rachel, So Yaakov Avinu helped her. And she was she was going out there. She was there with the shepherds. Right, in a sense, that's a male role, yes. And you know that to that extent, the point is correct. But then Yaakov Avinu comes along and helps her, because she would have had to wait who knows how long to be able to water the sheep. And in this case, of course, these damsels are in distress, and Moshe Rabbeinu comes and saves them from the shepherds who were harassing them. So in a certain sense, they are doing the work that these other male shepherds are doing. In another sense, they're also playing the male who comes along is playing the role. So it's a good point. Okay. So we move on, if it's okay. I mean, that was not really a big deal what we just talked about, so we could just move on from that. it's a very, very, very loaded and full subject, which requires its own separate treatment. The pasuk goes on, Ulchayan Midyan Sheva Banos. Right, so the Kayan Midyan had seven daughters, and they came out, and the Royim came and chased them away. Aigar Shum. So the Medrash famously discusses the fact that he was Kayan Midyan. He had been Kayan, means a priest. So it's strange that Moshe Rabbeinu should find refuge here in the house of such a person. So says the Medrash famously, that what happened was that even before Moshe Rabbeinu had an ability to expose Yisrael to the Jewish people and to the astounding events that happened around the Jewish people, even before the beginning of Parshas Yisrael, where Yisrael joins the Jewish people after Yitzias Mitzrayim, maybe after Matan Torah, and Vayishma Yisrael, and Yisrael hears everything, and Vayisaper Moshe L'chaisnei, and Moshe Rabbeinu tells them all the stories, and Yisrael says, Ata Yadati, now I know that Hashem is greater than all the other gods and all the other forces that are there in the world. Even before that happens, Yisrael, says the Medrash, had already, he tried them, he rejected them. Yisrael already had renounced all of the Avodah Zarah, because Moshe Rabbeinu would not have been made to find his refuge, his salvation, in the place, in the house of an Avodah Zarah.
Look where he grew up.
Okay.
You're in Paro's house. It's stupid.
Okay. Good question. And you could ask other questions, right? His first manos was in the house of Paro. Now, remember what we learned earlier, what everybody knows, is that he was really under the care of Basya Bas Paro. And when Basya Bas Paro saved him, we say exactly the same thing, which is that she went to save Moshe Rabbeinu. No, she didn't go to save Moshe Rabbeinu. She was going to be Tevel, to cleanse herself of all of the Avodah Zarah of the house of Paro. And right then, she finds Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't have been saved by an Avodah Zarah. So, of course, Basya was in the house of Paro, but Moshe Rabbeinu was under Basya. And therefore, as such, he was really in the hands of someone who wasn't an Avodah Zarah. So, for the Medrash, there's that kind of consistency. But, you know, when Yaakov Avinu had to run away from Esav, where did he run? He ran to the house of Lavan. And Lavan was an Avodah Zarah, and he didn't even clean his house out of the Avodah Zarah when he was there. So, you know, I think that there is some difference to be noted between the two of them. And basically is as follows, that there's even a difference between Yaakov Avinu and Eliezer. When Eliezer went to the house of Lavan, and he wasn't even going to be saved, so what does Lavan, it was the house of Besuel at the time, so Lavan comes out and he greets him and he says, V'anoichi pinisi abayis, I empty the house out of Avodah Zarah. I empty the house out of Avodah Zarah. So therefore you can come in. When the same Lavan greeted the grandchild of Avram Avinu, the child of the whatever it is of Yitzchak, for whom this Eved had come, for the Eved of Avram, he cleaned out the house. When Yaakov Avinu came, Lavan didn't clear out the house of Avodah Zarah. And I'll bring you a proof, because when Yaakov Avinu left 20 years later, Rachel took it upon herself to quote unquote clean out the house from Avodah Zarah. So what's going on? So the thing is that I would say, what I would believe is that this is really symptomatic of the difference between Yaakov Avinu on the one hand and Avraham Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu on the other hand. If you have three. So what's the idea? Because Yaakov Avinu was, the nature of Yaakov Avinu was that Yaakov Avinu was hiding, and Yaakov Avinu was there in Golos. He ran away from Esav. He swallowed it when Shechem did what Shechem did. It was only his sons who stood up to oppose. Yaakov Avinu is the Okev. Yaakov Avinu represents himself as the heel, as the lowly one today, as the Okev, as the one who only in the end will rise. But in the interim, he manages to be under the thumb of others. He manages to live in that kind of a state of being. That's Yaakov Avinu's story. Avraham Avinu doesn't do that. Avraham Avinu is the iconoclast. He goes and he smashes the Avodah Zarah in his house and in his land. Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu represents the emergence of the geula, of the strength of the Jewish people. So for Moshe Rabbeinu, or for Avraham Avinu's messenger, to be there and being the guest, the protectee, if that's a correct word, of Avodah Zarah, is pastnished. It doesn't fit with who they were. But Yaakov Avinu is a different story. So yes, in this case, Moshe Rabbeinu is running away because of his verve, because of what he had done. But nevertheless, that Hashem should give him money specifically by an Eved Avodah Zarah. So therefore, Chazal say that in fact, in advance of this, they had already rejected, Yisrael had already rejected Avodah Zarah. And says the Medrash, and that's why the Rayim came and Vayagarshum. You could imagine that it was simply because, as you noted before, here you had women doing men's work. Yisrael, it seems, had no sons. His daughters were going and being the shepherds. So what would happen? So those nasty boys would go and push around the weaker girls and say, "You get away from here! Right? Where are you? What are you doing around here?" However, says the Medrash, that has nothing to do with it. That wasn't what was going on. The Maral, in fact, has a beautiful diuk in the fact that it was not because of simple, you know, the strong men taking advantage of the weaker women. Because what would be the correct way to say about chasing away women? Vaygarshun. The feminine form has a nun at the end, not a mem at the end. And yet it uses the masculine form. And so says the Maral, it's accenting that it was not taking advantage of them, chasing them away because we're men and you're women, vayagorashun. But it was because of Yisrael. And because of the theological choice, the religious choice which Yisrael had made, that he had rejected their Avodah Zarah. And because he had rejected the Avodah Zarah, niduhu me'etzlai, they imposed sanctions upon him. They said he has no right to be part of their community. And that was the nidui that led to the girush. The Medrash compares it to the language that is used when Adam Arishain was menuda, was sent away from Gan Eden, also because, of course, of to some degree of matters of belief. But there he was on the wrong side. Here Yisrael was on the right side. But as far as they were concerned, he was on the wrong side. So therefore, that's the Medrash, and that's an important idea. And in fact, similar to the idea that as Basya was bathing herself, cleansing herself of the Avodah Zarah, that's when she steps forth to save Moshe Rabbeinu. In this story, where the seeds of the saving of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Moshe Rabbeinu is going to be, quote-unquote, given refuge by Yisrael, not saved, but given refuge by Yisrael because of what happens here at the well. What happens here at the well is an expression of Yisrael's rejection of Avodah Zarah. So it's very beautiful and elegant in the typical way of the way the Torah works, that It's not, okay, you know, it so happened that Moshe met these girls at the well, and they happened to be from just the right family, and because Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't be saved by an Eved Avodah Zarah. But Moshe Rabbeinu only stepped into the story with these girls because of the fact that they were the right family. Because their distress call came only because of the Emunah Tahira of Yisrael. So that's how beautifully it comes together that this was primed for Moshe Rabbeinu to step in. Very nice. But the Maharal says, I'm not satisfied. And the reason why he's not satisfied is because it's one thing to say that Moshe Rabbeinu needed to have a place to go. He needed somewhat to be saved. And he couldn't be saved by Neved Avodah Zarah, so don't worry. Yisrael was cured. He wasn't anymore an Eved Avodah Zarah. However, the problem is deeper than that. Because Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't just saved by Yisrael. In fact, he wasn't really saved by Yisrael. He stayed there. But a big deal was that Moshe Rabbeinu married the daughter of Yisrael. Tzipai Reishas Moshe. And exactly when that child of Yisrael was from, whatever she was from, not perfectly clear. And there's a contrast which Chazal themselves give when they speak about how Aaron, the Pasuk says he married Elisheva Bas Aminadav. Elisheva was the daughter of Aminadav. She was the sister of Nachshon ben Aminadav, who was the leading prince in the Jewish people. He was the prince of Yehuda, Nachshon ben Aminadav. Everybody knows his leadership. Yehuda would be the kings of the Jewish people. So yes, during his career, Moshe Rabbeinu was the king of the Jewish people. But ultimately, when there would be kings from the Shvatim, it would be from Yehuda. So Nachshon ben Aminadav, you know, he was the one who first went, led the Jewish people ahead, plowed into the Yamsuf. So Aaron HaKohen married Elisheva Bas Aminadav Achos Nachshon. And that's Yichus. That's very defined and unique, special ancestry. And because of that, says the Gemara in Bava Basra, Aaron had Nadav, Avihu, Elazar, Isamar, Pinchas, you know, whereas Moshe Rabbeinu did not have such nachas from his children. And the Gemara says, because by contrast to Aaron, who married this person with tremendous pedigree, Moshe Rabbeinu did not. So, while, of course, you know, as a note, David HaMelech didn't come from the pedigree of Elisheva Bas Aminadav alone. David HaMelech came from a great Giyaris, Rus HaMoyaviyah. And therefore, this is far from an absolute, and sometimes it seems, in fact, to perhaps play in the other direction, like we discussed in a shiur recently, where we talked about how specifically it seems to come Moshe Rabbeinu from the house of Paro and so on and so forth. But there is something called Yichus. We don't reject the value of something called the Yichus, of the significant pedigree that stands behind. And the Gemara points that out, that that's a factor. So the question is, why? Okay, that Moshe Rabbeinu had to run away from the Jewish people, we understand. That Hashem would make things nice, that he has to be saved, he'll be saved by someone who rejected Avodah Zarah. Okay. However, the question is, why should Moshe Rabbeinu marry specifically into this particular situation? Which again, the Gemara sees that to some degree it did make a difference. That's the question which the Maharal is concerned about. That's the question which the Maharal is bothered by, which he's coming now to address. Okay?
Did he become Kenyan?
Sorry?
Didn't he become Kenyan again?
So there are midrashim which tell that story. We're not going there right now, huh? You need to have a wife. The Maharal says, however, something else, something fascinating. He says it here. He says it in the Be'er HaGaila, and we'll see that. Some of the other things here he addresses. He's not in the Be'er HaGaila. This is not the primary issue which he's struggling with. Struggling with another issue, which the Maharal is also going to deal with here in this section. Maharal says as follows. we have learned previously about Moshe Rabbeinu, and that Moshe Rabbeinu had the status of tzura, of form, to the chomer, to the matter of the Jewish people. If we spoke earlier this morning about male-female, that the man is the tzura to the woman's chomer, well, it's of course it doesn't only work by male-female. Right? Melech, and in this case, Moshe Rabbeinu as Nosein HaTorah, as the one who is, the one who gives over the Torah, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, to the Jewish people, Moshe Rabbeinu had the aspect of tzura relative to the Jewish people. And to some degree, this is all part of these factors that we've talked about before, of Moshe Rabbeinu not being of the Jewish people, but to some degree coming from the outside of the Jewish people. And the way the Maharal, in other words, because he has to bring this tzura to bear upon the Jewish people. And one of the things which the Maharal focuses on in presenting this here is what Chazal say, which is that Shokul Moshe ki Yisrael v'Yisrael ki Moshe. On some level, Moshe Rabbeinu is equal in weight to the Jewish people, and the Jewish people equal in weight to Moshe Rabbeinu. This does not mean, of course, literally. However, the Gemara darshans it from the fact that, in fact, by Yisro, it says, Vayishma Yisro, everything that Hashem had done l'Moshe u'l'Yisrael. Right? To Moshe and to the Jewish people. So that is expressing some kind of a parallel. Maral brings a famous medrash where somebody went and darshan and said that there was a woman in Mitzrayim who gave birth to shishim ribay bekeres echa, to 600,000 in one pregnancy. Right? So one said, remember, six bekeres echa, one said, six, 60 bekeres echa, one said, there was a lady who gave birth to 600,000 in one pregnancy. Wow! That's better than minnows, right? Like, you know, like what's what does that mean? So they laughed him off the stage until he explained there was a woman named Yecheved, and she gave birth to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Moshe Rabbeinu was equal keneged kol Yisrael. And if you want to look further, this is something which is found in many places, including virtually, one might say virtually explicitly in the Torah, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe Rabbeinu, "I'm going to destroy the Jewish people, and you will be the replacement. I will make you into this great nation." So there are those who understand that as part of this idea of Shokul Moshe ki Yisrael v'Yisrael ki Moshe. I want to, by the way, just I can't resist that because I think it's a chiddush that I developed once, and that's not a machshava chiddush, but it's even a halacha chiddush to some degree. But there's a famous dispute about the smicha, which was the ultimate smicha of the Sanhedrin, that was discontinued in the time of the Gemara, in the time of the Romans, where they disallowed, they made the smicha illegal, so it was discontinued. And so we have no smuchim, you know, we have nobody with that level of authority in time of the Tanoim, that it was discontinued. So the thing is that the Rambam, the definition of smicha was always people who got smicha directly, chain, linked back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And when it was discontinued, so what's the hope of it ever starting up again? By definition, it wouldn't be able to start up again. However, the Rambam famously holds that it will start up again. And it was the basis, the Rambam was the basis for efforts in the 16th century, in the time of the Beis Yosef, to actually start it up again, Mari Beirav and others, and other more laughable but modern attempts to restart it. But the idea was that the Rambam says that, you know, we daven in Shemoneh Esrei, we say, Hashiva Shefteinu Kvar Rishayna, restore our judges, and then we say, the Rambam says that the pasuk says, "Vashiva shevtach kvar ishena v'yatzach kivatchila achareichen yikar lach ira tzedek yiranem." And I have to restore your judges, and then Yerushalayim will be restored. So the Rambam says it is necessarily the case that you have to have a restoration of the Sanhedrin before the Geula, which means don't tell me stories that Moshe Rabbeinu is going to come back and bring back the Smicha, because the Geula is going to come only after the judges have already been restored. So says the Rambam, it's possible that the Jewish people, if they get together and they're Samech somebody, so that they're able to restore the smicha. If the Jewish people agree upon somebody, then they'll be able to restore the smicha. So whatever the details are beyond our discussion, but I was thinking that the pshat is that Moshe Rabbeinu shakul ki Yisrael, and that Moshe Rabbeinu has the traditional way is the connection which Moshe Rabbeinu established with Hashem. So Moshe Rabbeinu privately, so to speak, there's no such thing as Moshe Rabbeinu privately, but Moshe Rabbeinu himself, as who he was, which is not an individual, so he appointed the judges, and then from that power continued from Moshe Rabbeinu's power. But when Moshe Rabbeinu's power to appoint judges was interrupted by the fact that there was no continuity, the only way to restore it is for the parallel strength, which is the national strength of the Jewish people. Moshe himself possessed the national strength of the Jewish people, so he would do that. But the Jewish people would be able to restore it. And just to add, if you think about it, Moshe Rabbeinu's power itself came from where? Not from Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu's power itself came from the Jewish people. Because, of course, originally you have much more, like we discussed before, but his power as the Navi was because Klal Yisrael said to Moshe Rabbeinu, Kirav Ato Shema, you're the one who should go, and you hear from Hashem, and you'll tell us. So that strength position came because it was given to Moshe Rabbeinu by the Jewish people. So when a time will come and the Jewish people will do the same thing with a smicha, that may be possible as well. Okay, that's just an aside, because it's a chiddush which is chaviv to me, so I wanted to share it. But the Gemara goes back here, the Maral goes back here, and he speaks about this, that Klal Yisrael, that Moshe Rabbeinu is a parallel to Klal Yisrael, he's a tzura mashlim of Klal Yisrael. So he says, let me ask you a question. Who should marry Moshe Rabbeinu? If Moshe Rabbeinu is, in a sense, the tzura for the entirety of the Jewish people, which individual from that mass would make sense to be the match of Moshe Rabbeinu? It creates just a mismatch. It's like Moshe Rabbeinu would overwhelm, in a certain sense, any Isha Yisrael. So therefore, says the Maral, the only way that Moshe Rabbeinu would be able to marry a woman as an individual woman was when that woman herself was somehow not subsumed under the regular heading of the B'nai Yisrael, when she also was unique, when she also was from the outside. And writes the Maral, a wife is supposed to be, again, sort of like a parallel, a mate. How could one woman of the 600,000, that Moshe Rabbeinu was the kenegdai of the 600,000, how could one, you know, 0.00, whatever it is, right, be his kenegdai? But the daughter of Yisrael, as someone who was outside of the 600,000 at this point in time, did not have this issue. Moshe Nivdal Yisrael, Moshe Rabbeinu was set from the Jewish people. He wasn't part of the 600,000, and so too she was not part of the 600,000. Because her nefesh hagiyeret zocha azruya l'Moshe Shinidal Yisrael. So he says, look, it's true, still, so she wasn't part of Israel, so there were whatever drawbacks that had in terms of the yichus, in terms of what would be produced there, ultimately in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, but on the other hand, this was what created the possibility for Moshe Rabbeinu to have this basuk. That's what he says, and he says, he recognizes, many times the Maral says things, and this is good, you know, here's the explanation. And many times the Maral puts in like sort of a postscript, and he says, Havin hadvarim ha'ilu kehev nifloim. He says, think about this, because it's nifloim. Because now nifloim, we would say, especially if we're from California, we would say that it's amazing, right? But nifloim means amazing, but it also means it's distant. In other words, this is an unusual idea. It's such an irony that because Moshe Rabbeinu was so great, and therefore, you know, this is going to have to be the result. But he's saying, look, you have to understand that Moshe Rabbeinu played this role in relating this way to the Jewish people as a whole. So picking out one as Ishtai would create an incredible imbalance. And the Maral brings to this, and this is really the Chazal which is troubling him, which he's addressing in the Be'er HaGoyla, he brings to this another Chazal about Moshe Rabbeinu. A Chazal which the skeptics and the critics about Chazal went crazy about, and we who are not skeptics or critics about Chazal struggle to understand, which is of course the difference. Everybody has questions. The question is whether the questions are meh, or the questions are, I need to understand what they mean by this. And the question, the Chazal which they deal with is the following. In Tehillim, it says, "Vayikanu l'Moshe b'machane." When it's, you know, there are a few kapitlach tilim which are sort of condensed histories of the Jewish people. It's the way we praise Hashem for, you know, we went through down this whole long road together with all of these stops. So it tells a compacted history, and there are several places in Gemara and Midrashim where they use the version which is brought in the Tehillim to learn things about the story. Right, Pinchas stood vayefalil and it stopped the plague. What does that mean? Right, so does it add something to the story? So some say that it was the tefillas of Pinchas. Pinchas davin doesn't say that anywhere in the Chumash. We learn it from the account in Tehillim. So here it says vayikanu lemaisha b'machane, and that's in the story of Kairach. And the Gemara learns from it. The Maral quotes the Gemara Ma'ir Katan. It's also a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and he also quotes the Medrash Tanchuma that says, "Melamed shekol echad ve'echad kinei l'moshe me'ishtai." Everyone did vayekane. They did what's called kinui. What is kinui? Kinui. The term of kinui is found by the Saita. The Saita, the unfaithful wife. So, what happens? The husband sees that she's somehow having some kind of connection, relationship, liaison with another man. So he expresses his kinui, his zealousness, his, so to speak, possessiveness. No, you cannot. Vayikanu l'moshe b'machane, says the Chazal, that everybody warned their wives, stay away from Moshe Rabbeinu. Kol echad ve'echad, each and every one, kinei l'moshe me'ishtai. So the question is, what on earth does that mean? That they were chayshed Moshe Rabbeinu? That Moshe Rabbeinu was going to take advantage of their wives? Moshe Rabbeinu, kedosh Hashem, that Moshe Rabbeinu was going to somehow take advantage of their wives. How do you understand it? So, you know, the Marsha discusses over there in the Gemara, Rashi even indicates this to some degree, if I remember correctly, in Sanhedrin, that the idea is that they were suspicious because Moshe Rabbeinu separated from his own wife. Moshe Rabbeinu, as part of his Nevuah, separated from his own wife. So they looked at Moshe Rabbeinu and they said, come on, who's supposed to do that? Right? You know, the priests, they may not be married, but they have to find some other outlet for their drives, right? Yeah. Right. Just look at the front page of any newspaper, right? So you know, it's very hard for human beings to imagine that this part of life doesn't exist, and therefore they imagined and sort of transferred the same kind of perspective on Moshe Rabbeinu. So they said, what do you mean? He left his wife. Watch out. Watch out for Moshe Rabbeinu. He's going to take advantage. Which is, of course, a very, in itself, a very, what you would have is that what's happening is, you know, there's biur to it, there's understanding to it, which is that, you know, Kairach's dispute, we point out at other times, it's a very sobering thing, but Kairach's dispute with Moshe Rabbeinu uses much of the same terminology of Miriam and Aaron's challenge to Moshe Rabbeinu. When Miriam and Aaron challenged Moshe Rabbeinu, what was it about? It was about the fact that he left his wife. And what did they say? They said, is Moshe Rabbeinu the only one who Hashem speaks to? Hashem has spoken to us as well. Harakach b'Moshe diber Hashem halegam banu diber. And in that way they said, if we're normal, and we have a normal husband-wife relationship, why should Moshe Rabbeinu be doing it any differently? Korach said similar language. Korach, of course, did it in a very different way than Miriam and Aaron. But Korach said, the entire community of the Jewish people, they all are prophets. We all, Shamum Behar Sinai, as Rashi brings over there, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, we all prophesized and heard the original commandments from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So why does Moshe Rabbeinu, Madua Tisnas Al Kal Hashem, why does Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen, why do they lift themselves up over everybody else? So they didn't understand the difference. They didn't understand that when Moshe Rabbeinu went on to Har Sinai, he became like a malach. And so he separated from his wife, that's the language of the Rambam, it's not Hasidish, right? He became like a malach. And he didn't eat, he didn't drink, so he didn't have bodily needs and he didn't have bodily wants. So Moshe Rabbeinu separated from his wife, you know, that's part of the picture, of course there's much more to it, but it becomes meaningless. So Moshe Rabbeinu has this need unfulfilled, so he's going to go do something which is forbidden? Ridiculous. But if your argument is that Moshe Rabbeinu is just like the rest of us, then it's not ridiculous. That's one way of learning it. But the Maral learns it completely differently. And the Maral understands it in a certain sense, figuratively. And he says that the idea is because Moshe Rabbeinu was the Tzura of all of Klal Yisrael. And isn't the husband supposed to be the Tzura of his wife? So every husband was mekane liishtoi. Okay, we'll stop. We'll pause there. But that's sort of like the general picture. Every husband was mekane liishtoi. Every husband was warning his wife about Moshe Rabbeinu. Watch it. Moshe Rabbeinu's influence, the influence which Moshe Rabbeinu would ultimately have, would somehow incur and encroach rather upon the relationship which the husband had with his wife. That's the idea. You know, I want to bring a mushel to this. And again, it's not a 100% clear to me that what the Maral is doing here in terms of figurative versus literal. It's not perfectly clear to me. But I want to just bring you an example. And lahavdil elef alfei havdolos. Lahavdil elef alfei havdolos. To distinguish 1,000 times over, but I think you'll understand in a certain sense what I mean. When you have figures who are leaders of, let's say, cults, communes, right? These kinds of communities where everybody is eating out of their hand in terms of what they think, what they believe, the way they look at the world, the rules which they use to live their lives. So, of course, much of the time, these are very, very horrible, negative things. And very often, a paragraph in the story is about how the person in charge was also taking advantage of everybody's wife. Literally or figuratively, you understand the tension that exists. Does the husband feel like he has his wife? Does the husband feel like what we spoke about before? There's a notion of chaymer and tsura, and the husband somehow is supposed to be putting the direction and the imprint, you know, the family name. Or is that role usurped to a great degree by this dominant figure that's there in their lives? Says the Maral, Shokul Moshe ki Yisrael. Because of Moshe Rabbeinu's role in this global sense, the same way I told you, says the Maral, that Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't marry any particular woman. in Klal Yisrael, because that would be ridiculous. What, he's going to establish this relationship with this one woman who's just like a fraction of all the people in Klal Yisrael that Moshe Rabbeinu is having this impact upon? He could only have it with somebody who came from the outside, so to speak, you know, outside, not under the influence, so to speak, of Moshe Rabbeinu. So, but that was what the men of the Jewish people sensed. And again, whether they sensed it in the base way, that because Moshe Rabbeinu has this tremendous role, so therefore he's actually going to intrude physically on our relationship, or whether they understood it in the more broad way, that Moshe Rabbeinu was intruding upon their relationship in the sense of Chaymer Vetzura. But that was the idea. That's the idea of Moshe Rabbeinu having this quote-unquote relationship with everybody. And I believe again that the Maharal is really not so much taking it literally, because he says if this was the complaint, then why is there a taina against Kairach? It's true. Moshe Rabbeinu was incredibly influential on all of the Jewish people. And therefore, why would they be upset in this Vayikanu, in this thing? And says the Maharal, the reason is because the impact which Moshe Rabbeinu had was on such a sublime level. There's such a thing as tsura which is attached to chaymer. There's such a thing as form which is attached to matter, and there's such a thing as form which is itself sort of above matter. And the level in which the husbands and wives of the Jewish people related to each other was that of tsura attached to chaymer. Moshe Rabbeinu was sort of a layer above that, and therefore there was room for their relationship. It was because, as we said before, the people didn't have this recognition of Moshe Rabbeinu somehow being above and beyond, that they presumed Moshe Rabbeinu to be coming in on their level, and therefore somehow getting in the way of their relationship. But in fact, that wasn't the case. It was on a different level. And the Maharal brings, to illustrate this point, the words of Moshe Rabbeinu said in response to the claims of Kairach. And what's that? What did Moshe Rabbeinu say? Right? Kairach accused Moshe Rabbeinu of nepotism, of trying to grab honor and a high position for himself. So what was Moshe Rabbeinu's response? Lechamer echad mehem nosasi v'loy harayosi asachad mehem. I didn't take a donkey from them, and I didn't cause harm to any of them. I didn't take a company donkey. Right? So what's the idea? So the thing is that the truth is, why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he take a donkey from them? I mean, come on. Moshe Rabbeinu, is everything he's doing on behalf of the Jewish people. He should be entitled to a company car. But the idea of Lechamer Echad Mehem Nasasi was that even though Moshe Rabbeinu was this and was doing all of this for Klal Yisrael, but that's the difference between him and a melech, between him and a king. A king is part of the people. He's supposed to be the tzura of the people, but he's tzura hamutbas b'chaymer. He's a form within the world of the material. Moshe Rabbeinu's kingdom over the Jewish people was of the Nisan HaTaira. It was sublime. It was of a different realm and a different level. And therefore, he didn't even take those things that one would normally imagine he would be entitled to, because he didn't relate to them. He didn't connect to them in that way, on that level. Loi chamer echad mehem nasasi. And because Moshe Rabbeinu was in that sense in a completely different stratosphere, in that sense, that's why this assumption about somehow his presence intruding on their relationship with their wives, which is a relationship, yes, of a tzura, but a tzura mutpas b'chaymer, was afbes. Was not something that had any room for it to really exist, and was therefore only a result of their lower assumptions about Moshe Rabbeinu than was the actual reality.
What about Tzipora? Didn't he have obligations to her? She's sort of like the stoic Korban here.
Okay, so you have to understand what happens when Moshe Rabbeinu is Pirish from Tzipora, and yes, you know, that's why Tzipora ruefully says, when she hears about other Nevi'im, she says, oh, poor wives, you know, Nebuch. Right, their husbands became Nevi'im, hope they don't have the experience which I had. And Tzipora, to some degree, yes, she does lose out, as do the children of Moshe Rabbeinu lose out. But this is Moshe Rabbeinu going off the planet. In a certain sense, Moshe Rabbeinu's marriage to Tzipora takes place outside of the realm of his leadership of the Jewish people. Marriage is usually a prerequisite. Marriage is usually something which is wanted. Marriage is usually necessary. A kohen has to be married. A kohen has to have a sub-wife ready, waiting in the wings in case his wife dies. Adam HaRishon, Hashem said it's not good for him to be alone. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he gets the job, he leaves his wife. Even before the job of Matan Torah.
Right,
when he went down to Mitzrayim, it wasn't possible that he was supposed to take Tzipora. He took her originally. He wanted to take her. But she ended up sending her back.
So why did he end up getting married? Is there a lesson in him getting married?
Moshe Rabbeinu did not take on this role. He barely took it on when Hashem gave it to him.
In all these descriptions of the pre-Matan Torah about Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, is the Maharal speaking of Moshe Rabbeinu, or Moshe Rabbeinu as he was at that time? You know, the idea of Moshe Rabbeinu being connected to all of Israel at that time,
right?
He wasn't. Or I assume he wasn't.
He wasn't yet activated in that role. And it's a very good point and a very good question. You would say the same Moshe Rabbeinu, when he assumed that role, had to separate from his wife. So then that means that before that he was different. But I mean, the Maharal doesn't speak to it directly, but I think we have to understand that it's already there to some degree. It's not just potential. It's not just potential. There's some actuality already. All of the things that we learned previously, for example, why Moshe Rabbeinu is in the house of Paro. Why Moshe Rabbeinu has to experience this of being outside, because he's not Bichlal Yisrael, he's not part. And Moshe Rabbeinu is, from the moment that he's born, there's something which is complete and which is different about him. So Moshe Rabbeinu already starts off, yes, it's not actualized 100% until he's appointed, and certainly until he's appointed to take the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, maybe not even until he's actually appointed as the one who's going to communicate Torah to the Jewish people. But there are significant seeds of it that are already really, really in place, and that's what leads to this.
So very interesting. I don't know, I didn't say that Mara said it, but when he said the response of Lochamor Echad Mehem Asasi, usually we...
Chamor.
Lochomer Echad Mehem
Asasi. Right, correct. Right, Mara says it, yeah.
Also...
he doesn't say it over here, by the way. But he doesn't make the play on the word, but he says it in other places. Yes.
So put two of these things together, I mean, one could easily say that the Torah was not part of Chai Yisrael before Matan Torah, but once Matan Torah came, she was just as much a part of Chai Yisrael as everybody else, because everybody had the same gerus. So maybe it was partly that he had separated from her, because she was now inside Chai Yisrael. And she was now just like everybody else, so she wasn't. She was no longer outside.
That's a very good chap. That's a very good chap. I don't know that it's. I mean, again, Maral certainly doesn't allude to it, as far as I know, and I don't know that it's faithful to the way the need for the separation of Moshe Rabbeinu is conveyed. But because it's not seen as a Tzipora issue as much as a Moshe Rabbeinu issue. It's not because Tzipora graduated or, you know, became something else, but because Moshe became something else. But it's food for thought. It's an interesting coincidence, so to speak. Yeah.
There's the idea that the men didn't feel that they were like a Tzura because they don't really do anything separate from Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, they don't have their identity, and they don't, you know, their homes and everything are all based on what they're learning from Moshe. So, therefore,
so you're arguing that in the Midbar, where they didn't bring home the brisket, that they would be much more likely to be threatened by a Moshe Rabbeinu than.
And they're thinking the relationship is like, I'm not.
Yeah. It's definitely a fair suggestion. I don't know, but it's a good suggestion. They felt less masculine, so to speak, because you know, if, the way life was in the Midbar and the roles that they played and didn't play. That's a very nice, fair hope.
Okay. It seems like the rabbi was talking about when Moshe came to Israel in Egypt and he brought his wife and his kids, and Aaron said, why...
You have enough. Yeah.
You have enough slaves. Like, that doesn't really make a good sense argument, because since they were Levim, they weren't slaves anyway. So, I guess it sounded like you were kind of tying that into that... how Moshe Rabbeinu was going to be more of a unique one alone figure.
Moshe Rabbeinu had a resistance in a certain sense to being so completely unique. He wanted, as we discussed before, he wanted in a certain sense to be more part of Klal Yisrael. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role for him had him apart, parallel, and so on and so forth.
But is Aaron's argument that you're bringing more people to become slaves, which really wasn't a valid argument, into it?
There's a validity to the argument. But if Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to become part of the people, he wants his family to be part of the situation. He doesn't want to be a carpetbagger. Okay. Good day. Good luck.